you, Jacqueline. Good morning, everyone, and thanks to CEDA for inviting me along to talk about climate policy in the year to come. Climate policy was starting to look like the most exciting bit of economic policy until we had something truly horrible come along, the global financial crisis, but I'll try and make it as scary as the global financial crisis is. 2008 was a remarkable year for climate policy development in Australia. We had a series of very detailed and long reports, two reports from Professor Garnaut, actually more than two, but two major ones, a green paper outlining some ideas for the design of an emissions trading scheme in Australia, some Treasury modelling, which purported to show us what it was going to cost, and then a white paper with a very, very detailed design of what's called a CPRS, Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, which is essentially an emissions trading scheme for Australia. I tend to use the words interchangeably. Along with submissions and background papers, by my calculations, that's four times War and Peace. So I don't know about you, but I've had a very literary year in the past year keeping up with all this stuff. I think in the year to come, there's really five main issues that will define the economics and the politics of climate policy. And these are in no particular order, but the first issue will be actually coming to grips with the design that's been put forward by the government, with the actual detail of what the emissions trading scheme means, who it's going to hurt, who it's going to benefit, how much it's going to cost, how complicated it's going to be. The second issue is a very important one, which is only just starting to seep into the consciousness of people who notice these sorts of things, and that's the very big mismatch between the timing of the costs and benefits of climate policy, and I'll talk about that in some detail. Along with that, we'll have a series of fairly complicated transitional issues. If we are to transition to a low-carbon economy in the short to medium term, there'll be some fairly serious transitional issues we need to worry about there. The fourth one is in fact probably really the big one, international negotiations. As we all know, Australia can do very little alone in terms of mitigating the effects of climate change. So the international stage, if you like, will be absolutely crucial in determining whether our own efforts have any meaning and whether in fact there will be any meaningful mitigation at all. And then the final issue is something that it was actually you weren't allowed to talk about a few years ago, adaptation, because it implies that if you were talking about adaptation, it meant you weren't serious about mitigation. But the evidence now is that adaptation is an absolute imperative. We can't not talk about it, and I think it will be a very important defining issue also over the year to come. So going through each of these issues, in the government's white paper and the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, there are 200 policy propositions that establish the scheme. There are 200 little bits of detail over which an explicit policy decision has been made. So that shows you that it's a fairly complicated piece of work. In principle, it's easy to establish an emissions trading scheme. You simply say that people who emit have to have a permit in order to be allowed to emit. If they don't have a permit available, they have to buy one off the market or buy one at an auction. And that some people, particularly trade-exposed industries, may get some initial allocation of permits. The idea is then that the people that can abate very cheaply won't need to buy permits, they'll just reduce their emissions, and the people that can't abate very cheaply will buy permits. That'll define a market price of carbon. That price will send a signal around the economy to all sorts of people that they need to change their behaviour in some way. In principle, it's very easy. You can sort of set it out in four simple points. In practice, it's enormously complicated. You have to worry about the design of the auction system. You have to worry about at what point in the production chain do you impose the carbon obligation. You have to worry about the fact that Australia's emissions trading is likely to start before any major efforts in our major trading partners. And so all of these things produce a lot of very complicated detail. People need to understand, businesses, consumers, in particular the politicians in the two Houses of Parliament that have to vote on this scheme, exactly what are the design choices? What were the reasons for those design choices? What are the implications for those design choices? in a sense, every single one of those 200 design choices had some options. The government could have gone this way, they could have gone that way. Right? We could auction all the permits, we could allocate all the permits. We could compensate trade-exposed industries by a lot more, we could compensate them by a lot less. We could impose the obligations upstream, downstream. There's a whole series of design choices, and every one of them is a choice. So it's important to understand why were those choices made, and what are the implications. Is it appropriate? Should we change? Is there elements of the design that we should change? And if we do change, what will the implications be? And I think a very important issue that will emerge is, well, it's already emerged, is the question of, have we, as in the nation and the government, done enough analysis of the implications of the scheme? I said before that Treasury put out a document looking at the cost of carbon mitigation in Australia. Their analysis was essentially long-term, essentially looking past the immediate short-term transitional issues. And there's quite a bit of disquiet that not enough analysis of the transition has been done in order to really understand some of the shorter term implications of this particular policy choice. So that'll be a big issue in the year to come. It'll be very interesting that if the scheme happens as according to plan, there's likely to be some initial auctions of permits towards the end of this year, forward auctions for the first commitment period in 2010. This will be the first time we've actually seen a permit price in Australia, if that happens, a real one that's driven by an actual policy. To date, our understanding of permit prices under an Australian-wide emissions trading scheme comes essentially from modelling. We don't have any real data, so it'll be really interesting to watch what happens in that first auction. Second big issue is the mismatch, if you like, or the lag between the costs of mitigation policy and the benefits of those policies. Now, I'm going to illustrate this with two charts from the Garnaut Climate Change Report, which is an excellent report. If anyone wants to really get on top of the scientific and economic issues involved, I'd recommend reading that report. What this chart shows is the orange line there is the cost to Australian GDP if we, the world, doesn't mitigate climate change. That is, if climate change continues according to the projections from the IPCC. And we see that the costs increase steadily. They peak at about 7% of gross national product, national income, out at 2100, but are significant numbers before then. What the blue and the green line show is what will happen to that cost if we start to mitigate. Now, the important point is that in these simulations, mitigation starts in 2013 in Garnaut's simulations. The policy, of course, is intended to start in 2010. But what you see is up to about 2040, there's no difference between those lines. That is, we start mitigation, but we don't reduce the cost of climate change for about 30 or 40 years. Another way of looking at that is to look at the net benefit cost payoff from climate policy. When we introduce climate policy in the early years, GNP growth is lower than it would otherwise be. What it would otherwise be is this zero line here. And this is percentage point growth difference from what it would otherwise be. In the early years, net GNP is lower than it would otherwise have been. And it breaks even, growth goes back to what it would otherwise have been in about 2058. Then by about 2090, the level of GNP, so these are growth rates, the level as in how many dollars, goes back to what it would otherwise have been. By about 2100, our descendants are richer than we would otherwise have been because we've mitigated climate change. And by about 2140, this whole thing shows a positive benefit-cost ratio. So what this is saying is that there's an enormous difference between the cost in timing between the costs that we incur today and when the benefits emerge. When this policy pays off, our current political leaders will be elder statespeople at best. The Prime Minister will be someone who hasn't been born yet. All right? And all of the companies that you currently work for won't exist, just judging by the normal life cycle of companies. They'll all be replaced by something with a funky name like Google or something like that. The point is, this is not a policy that brings short-term benefits. Right? There are net costs for most of the period of this policy, and certainly for all of the lifetimes of the people in this room. This is a policy for our children and our grandchildren to avoid climate change getting worse in the future. We don't, when we act now, and we, again, I mean the whole world, we don't actually stop climate change now. We stop it getting worse in the future, after about 50 years' time. So this is a really important dynamic, because this makes this policy totally different to any other economic reforms we may introduce. Most economic reforms have benefits in the short term. This one only has benefits in the very long term. This is not to imply, of course, that it's not worth doing, right? It's a question about what actions do we take to avoid dangerous climate change in the future. So that's the long term. So back to the short term again. If we do implement emissions trading in Australia, according to plan in 2010, we're going to be experiencing some fairly substantive transitions in our economy. And the most important transition is that there will be a transition from just Australia acting to global coverage. So in the early years of the scheme, our emissions intensive and trade exposed industries will face a major competitive challenge as we transition to a time in which other countries in the world also are effectively imposing a carbon price. And at the moment, you would see in the press, most of the politics about climate change is in fact, or climate change mitigation is in fact due to the treatment of so-called emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. That's why people like OneSteel in the paper today have said they won't support the scheme because they're worried about essentially their trade exposure. So that's going to be a really important debate over the next year and so. And of course, we're also going to be making major transitions, major transformations to our energy production system and to our manufacturing and production systems for other activities that produce greenhouse gases. This will involve, I think, considerable disruption in the long term. My guess is that the short-term costs will be higher than we think, only because we really only understand this from modelling. But the models that have been used are not particularly good at looking at short-term costs. But in the long term, I suspect it will be a lot less costly than we think. So there's a big transitional issue to worry about there. The next big issue, and maybe it's the big issue, certainly a lot of people would argue that it is, these are the international negotiations. Australia introducing emissions trading on its own, if no one in the rest of the world does, is of course completely pointless. We're responsible for less than 1% or less, depending on the scenario, of global greenhouse gas emissions. So our abatement will make no difference, particularly if there's leakage, if the activities that we're reducing ending up going overseas. So the international negotiations are fundamental, and they are probably the single most difficult thing in all of climate policy. And our view, Warwick and myself, is that there's a real risk, and actually and many others, that the negotiations are very much on a track of asking countries to commit to a particular quantity target for emissions, so reduce your emissions by X percent by a particular year, to commit to that regardless of what it turns out costing. And in simple terms, this is not stable. This is not politically stable. A politician today can't commit to an uncapped cost of someone that's going to be elected in the future. So people may make promises in the international negotiations, but there is no incentive for them to keep them. Once the cost of mitigation, particularly the transitional costs, become realised. So international negotiations are something to watch out for. I suspect that politically they'll be rather interesting in Australia, because if not much comes out of Copenhagen at the end of this year, and we're about to start emissions trading, there may be a big loss of enthusiasm in the Australian public for accepting mitigation costs when it doesn't look like the rest of the world is going to. Big issue. The final big issue is adaptation. And to understand adaptation, you need to understand something that's called committed climate change. Committed climate change is the climate change that's already locked in to the system, that we can do absolutely nothing about, even if we reduce emissions to zero today. Right? It's climate change that's locked in because of the very big inertias in the climate system. Now, there's a big discussion on this in the IPCC reports, in Garnaut's report, and in other places. I just wanted to show you a couple of pictures from an article that came out last week in the American Proceedings of the National Academies of Science by one of the IPCC lead authors and her colleagues, Susan Solomon. They did some model runs trying to understand inertia in the climate system. And what this shows you, the top panel shows you that if emissions grow at about 2% a year, which is fairly conservative compared to what they've been growing at, and we suddenly manage to stop emissions at particular concentration levels, let's say we manage to stop it at, say, 550 parts per million, the carbon in the atmosphere declines away very, very slowly. It doesn't just disappear. It hangs around for thousands of years. And, in fact, it hasn't gone back very much, even by the year 3000. So, in other words, this stuff that we've put out there is going to hang around, even when we stop emissions. More interesting is when you look at the profile for average temperature changes. So these are degrees Celsius, K is Kelvin, same thing, above historic levels. If we go, again, this point here is the 550, if we stop concentrations at 550, if we stop emissions immediately, you can see that the temperature change doesn't go away, again, for a couple of thousand years. So that is, whatever happens in this scenario, we're essentially guaranteed to get a 2-degree increase in global temperatures. That is, if you think climate change has been happening so far, we're actually going to get an increase in the rate of climate change over the next 100 years that we can really do nothing about. Interesting one for sea level is that when you stop sea level rise, and this is just from the warming of the ocean, this is not taking into account melting of the ice caps, this is just the fact that as water gets warmer it expands, so-called thermal expansion. Even again, when we immediately stop emissions, the thermal expansion never goes back, it continues, and it continues for another couple of thousand years. This is just one model run, of course, but combinations of model runs essentially show the same thing. And what Susan Solomon and company are arguing is that basically physical changes due to human-caused carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere today are expected to be largely irreversible. So the climate change that's happening now is irreversible, which means we really have to think very, very seriously about what adaptation means. I think adaptation, our response to this, is a real test of do we actually believe the science. Because it's exactly the same science that says global warming is happening, says that we need to adapt. It's exactly the same. Right? It comes from the same models, the same people. Adaptation doesn't require necessarily the government do anything. Individuals can adapt. So it'll be a great test of our revealed preference as individuals, whether we adapt our behaviour in order to cope with climate change. But it's also a policy area where at the moment it's a bit grey as to exactly what's the role of government and what's the role of individuals. When you have discussions about this, some people argue, well, it's all government. Government's got to do better planning. Government's got to make it illegal to build on the coast. Government's got to do all of these things. If you take that seriously, it means government's going to be doing pretty much everything to do with the outside environment for the next 100 years or so. I think we need to have a very serious policy debate about what is the trade-off here between individual action and individual responsibility, markets if you like, corporations, and what is collective responsibility for government. But as I say, that's going to be a major challenge, and we'll hear more and more about adaptation. And I guess we already are in the context of the awful Victorian bushfires, but also in the context of flooding up north and so on, both of which are expected to get worse and worse under most of the projections for climate change. So that's the five issues. It's going to be a very interesting year to come. As I say, all Australians, but particularly our politicians, have to come to grips with some very complicated issues. And if we do commence emissions trading next year in the financial year of 2010-11, then I think we'll see some very interesting transformations in our economy. Thank you very much.